Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Robert Mayer presiding.
Please be seated. We have one case scheduled for argument this morning. It's number 2009-1405, Cincinnati School District Board of Education versus Hamilton County Board of Revision. The appellant is the Board of Education, Mr. DiMuzio.
Thank you. May it please the court, there are two obvious errors that we pointed out in this case. The first one is that the BTA adopted an involuntary forced sale as the best evidence of value in a real estate tax valuation case. And that's a clear violation not only of Ohio statute, which we'll talk about, but also a long line of Supreme Court precedent. So we know that that was done in error. And the second error is one of jurisdiction. The BTA permitted a non-attorney to practice the unauthorized practice of law, basically in arguing its case.
Let me ask you about that. The case law on that, as it affects the jurisdiction of the boards of revision, usually involve the filing of the complaint itself. Now, are you maintaining that the filing of the complaint involved the unauthorized practice of law or just the appearance at the hearing?
That's a good question. There's a number of cases that have taken those steps that you've talked about that have kind of walked us from the filing stage further on. The most important case on the filing issue was the Sharon Village case, and that did involve a jurisdictional issue of the filing. What the as time went on and additional cases went up, the court created a number of exceptions to the Sharon Village rule, which of course prohibited non-attorneys from filing, and that's one that of the cases most important is the Dayton Supply case, which I was involved in and is cited I think in both the briefs. I was on the losing side of that one, but on the Dayton Supply case, they got at this issue of, okay, the guy who's a non-attorney filed, which he probably shouldn't have done, but he did that. He also appeared at the Board of Revision hearing in Montgomery County and he presented his evidence and said that he should win. And at the BTA, he had an attorney represent him at the BTA hearing. And then a Supreme Court, of course, he had an attorney. So the Supreme Court of Ohio dealt with this issue, and what they ruled was that they were going to craft a very narrow exception. And they made it clear that it was an exception. They were not overturning this 30 years of precedent that said that non-attorneys should not be representing corporations in this. But it said that in a case where they're simply filing and appearing at the Board of Revision hearing to present a value, and they're a corporate officer, and they met certain other requirements, that was okay, but it was very narrow. And I was going to read as part of my oral argument from the syllabus of the Dayton Supply case. They make the following statement, second paragraph. It says, public interest factors persuade us to hold that a corporate officer does not engage in the unauthorized practice of law by preparing and filing a complaint and presenting the claimed value of the property at a hearing before the Board of Revision on behalf of his or her corporation, so long as the officer does not make legal arguments, examine witnesses, or undertake other tasks that can be performed only by an attorney. So you can see that the Supreme Court got at your question, which is, what about the, not just the filing aspect, what happens if they go ahead and appear? Does that also begin to look like they're doing something that only an attorney can do? And they ended up ruling that not only, you know, could they make this filing, they could also actually appear at the hearing and present a value.
Now, your objection in this case goes to the Board of Revision hearing or the Board of Tax Appeals hearing or both?
It goes to his appearance at the Board of Tax Appeals. Okay. That was not, as you can tell, was not an exception that was carved out by the court. It was only for the Board of Revision. And it was only if they didn't act like an attorney, if they simply came and presented it. And as we noted in our brief, what's different about this case is Mr. Fennell actually appeared and argued, as an attorney argues, he presented evidence that he was not directly involved in. These were third-party documents. He presented them. He argued about what he thought their importance was and what he thought they represented. And we talk about that in detail in the brief. Those are the kinds of things attorneys do. Attorneys marshal evidence. Attorneys make arguments. And again, the our position is, and this I think will simplify, hopefully simplify the court's analysis, there is an overriding prohibition on non-attorneys filing and appearing. That is what we're hoping the court looks at and says, okay, we understand that. There are certain narrow exceptions, and so the only issue is, does this meet that narrow exception? And we think it doesn't, clearly.
Well, then the other question would be what, you know, in the Sharon Village line of cases, the court construed that as being a jurisdictional problem.
Yes.
Now, would that be a jurisdictional problem?
Yes.
In the middle of a hearing? If someone engages in the unauthorized practice of law, does that suddenly divest the tribunal?
Yes. Yes. And I had the same problem you have several years ago before Dayton Supply came out. I was curious, you know, why should it make any difference what happens 6 months later after it's been filed? Why should that make any difference? I don't know. The Supreme Court of Ohio seems to think it makes a difference. And so what they're saying is there are certain narrow, very narrow situations in which filings are made by non-attorneys that we're going to let those fly as long as they don't act like an attorney, don't argue, don't marshal evidence, all these sorts of things. So I agree with you. I'm not sure it makes any.
Well, I guess my question is really getting at is the distinction between there being some kind of error, let's say, in allowing the unauthorized practice of law, and whether or not that error affects the jurisdiction of the tribunal. Because I think in the Sharon Village cases, you can look at that and say, well, the court found some kind of a, because of the unauthorized practice of law, found some kind of a problem with the agency relationship, therefore the complaint was not properly filed, therefore it wasn't jurisdictionally proper. Whereas in the middle of a hearing, is it your theory that that would, that it divests the tribunal of jurisdiction, does that go back, relate back to the filing of the of the appeal, or how does it work?
I understand your struggle, and I agree with it. I agree with the logical implications of what you're saying, but for whatever reason, the Supreme Court has made the distinction that you're getting at. To me, Sharon Village made a lot of sense. It's an authorized practice of law to file, to do these things initially. That ought to affect jurisdiction. What happens 6 months later shouldn't make any difference. However, if you read Dayton Supply, it does. I found, you know, I was on the losing end, so I lost your argument to the Supreme Court, basically, which was all that's important is what happens initially. What happens 6 months later when somebody appears or doesn't appear at a board shouldn't make any difference, but it does. And so that's really all I'm saying is that the court, for whatever reason, wanted to craft an exception. They've crafted one. That's fine. This doesn't meet that exception. That's really all I'm saying.
Let me ask you another. I haven't had occasion to review the transcript. Were you at the BTA hearing?
For
the school board?
For this case?
For this case.
Yes.
Did you object to Mr. Fennell's statements?
I don't recollect it at the time. But again, of course, a jurisdiction could be raised at any time, jurisdictional issues. Dayton Supply.
Because obviously that would have been a way for the BTA to have dealt with it as an error if it had been objected to, and then they could have disregarded it or not admitted evidence or whatever.
I was actually surprised he was even at the hearing. I didn't think he would be Mr. Fennell. So it was just something he had to sort of deal with that day as it came up. He's allowed under Dayton Supply to appear at the Board of Revision hearing. You don't really know until they do whatever they do. But no, I don't think I did. I may have. I just don't recollect. I did want to mention what I feel is our more important argument, which is that the BTA relied upon a forced involuntary sale. The property at issue was owned by Maywood Associates. We know that from supplement page 9. You'll see the conveyance fee statement. It was not owned by HUD. It was involuntarily taken by forced sale. Mr. Fennell appeared at the Board of Revision hearing, under oath testified that he purchased this at a foreclosure sale that was arranged by HUD. So we know it was not Maywood Associates arranging an auction. We know that it was done by HUD, by a third party. The county's appraiser appeared at the Board of Revision hearing, and she testified on page 4 of the supplement also that it was a foreclosure sale. That is 100% of all the evidence in the record on the issue of whether it was voluntary, a foreclosure or not. That's it. For some reason, I don't know why, the BTA makes the following statement on page 8 of its decision. Given that the public sale was carried out voluntarily by the seller, we find that the auction per se contains the elements of an arm's-length transaction as required by Walter's Supra. They are confused. I don't know where they're coming up with the fact that this was somehow a voluntary sale. It was not a voluntary sale. Clearly, that was error. I think what confused them is the statute that we're relying upon, which is 57-1304, does use the word auction, also talks about forced sale. And they begin to get off on that auction tangent. The Walters case, which was a Supreme Court case which supports our position, says that sales must be voluntary, cannot be done by compulsion. That case happened to involve an auction that was voluntary, where the owner in that case decided to sell by auction, which is fine. That, of course, is different. We're not relying upon the auction itself. We're relying upon the fact that it was an involuntary sale under compulsion. So to us, if you look at the Berea case, look at the Walters case, there is a long line of Supreme Court cases clearly indicating that sales under compulsion, sales that are arranged by third parties in which the seller is required to sell, are not good evidence of value and should not be accepted.
So contention is it's not that an auction sale could, in a given case, be a sale that's probative of the value of the property.
Certainly.
But that it's only an auction that occurs in the context of a forced sale situation?
The fact that an auction occurred here is just, yes, it's part of the, it's not the basis of our legal, argument. It is that it was an involuntary sale done under compulsion. That's always been our position.
Let me ask you about who had the burden of proving what here. The evidence of the sale here, does that consist of what? A conveyance fee statement? The actual evidence of the sale?
Yeah, the evidence of the sale, I suppose, initially the burden would have been on the taxpayer because it was on at a higher value. My recollection is Fanco filed the original complaint and said, look, I paid $135,000, this is it. And so they had the burden. It was clear, as you can tell from the Board of Revision transcript, that all the evidence indicated that it was a foreclosure sale. And we don't know why the board, I can tell you as an aside, because I do a lot of these, it is not atypical for the Hamilton County Board of Revision to adopt forced sales. I don't know why they do. So this is a very important case. This has implications beyond just this case.
But in just looking at it at the Board of Revision level, what evidence was before the Board of Revision? Okay. What were they looking at?
They were looking at Supplement Number 9, which is a conveyance fee statement.
Okay.
They were listening to the testimony of Mr. Fennell under mm-hmm. oath, saying it was a foreclosure sale. The testimony, I think, of a Ms. McFeeder, if I recollect, who was the county rep, who testified that she had reviewed the conveyance fee statement and thought it was a foreclosure sale. So the school district in those situations, when there's little or no discovery, of course, at the Board of Revision level, we don't know what they're going to walk in with the other side. They clearly did have the initial burden, and they have a burden of showing that this, in fact, is an arm's length sale. When they come forward with it and they simply have the conveyance fee statement and they testify themselves that it was a forced sale, then I think they clearly have an additional burden of coming forward. As far as we're concerned, it's over at that point. There's really nothing. Once it's clear it's not arm's length, they then have to present an appraisal or something, and they haven't done that. And they would have to somehow show that the sale was not valid, which they haven't shown. Fraud, something like that, they haven't shown any of that.
So the school board's position is that then what the Board of Revision should have done is then go back to the auditor's value.
They should have, because there was not a valid sale and there was no other evidence.
Okay.
I think there's a recent Supreme Court, I think called Colonial Village, which indicates in that situation they should just retain the auditor's value.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DiMuzio. Mr. Cooper.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Chip Cooper. I'm appearing here today on behalf of FENCO. With the court's permission, I'll address the issues in the same way that they were just addressed, first with the unauthorized practice of law issue. I did not attend the hearing before the Board of Tax Appeals. However, the transcript is attached as an appendix to our brief. From my review of that transcript, it does not appear that Mr. DiMuzio objected to Mr. Fennell appearing and testifying on behalf of FENCO. He did raise an objection, I believe, as to a hearsay statement, but there was no objection that went to jurisdiction or any indication that he had any problem with Mr. Fennell appearing at that time. And of course, this was in the midst of the Board of Tax Appeals proceeding, and as the transcript indicates, Mr. Fennell gave testimony. He did not examine or cross-examine witnesses. He did not. He was asked to make a closing remark. Otherwise, it doesn't appear that he would have done that either. He simply appeared to give his own personal testimony. We don't believe that creates any jurisdictional hurdle for the Board of Tax Appeals or for this court. I think there would be obviously questions as to whether something is or isn't the unauthorized practice of law, and I'm not sure that that's something that's decided.
Is it necessary for the court to look at that and decide that, or is it your contention that this would not be a jurisdictional problem even if there were the unauthorized practice of law?
I don't think it would be a jurisdictional. Our position is it would not be a jurisdictional problem even if it was the unauthorized practice of law. With respect to the initial and primary proposition of law, as I understand the appellant's argument, it seems to be twofold. One is that, and somewhat circular, that an auction, in particular a foreclosure auction, is a forced sale and therefore cannot be used as value, and yet we keep coming full circle. It almost seems to be suggesting that there should be a per se rule, that any foreclosure auction is per se invalid and cannot be used to determine the value of the property, and that's simply not the case. Based upon established law. In this case, the facts indicate that there was not one but two auctions, that HUD put the property on the market for some period of time. They initially conducted an auction, withdrew the property, and conducted a second auction. They advertised the auction nationally. The testimony, I believe, was that there were 6 to 8 bidders on the property. There was active bidding for some period of time, resulting in a final price. That has all the indicia of an arm's length transaction. The fact that it occurred in this particular context, in the context of an auction or even a foreclosure auction, does not, in and of itself, determine that it was not an arm's length transaction. Supporting the fact that it was an arm's length transaction was Mr. Fennell's additional testimony and proof regarding the nature of the property itself. There was no question, I believe, that the property was dilapidated, all copper had been stripped from the property, every bathroom and kitchen had been destroyed, all the windows and doors were boarded up. The facts, certainly at the Board of Revision level, pointed clearly to a valuation that is what we have today, $135,000. At the next level, at the Board of Tax Appeals level, at that point, I believe it was incumbent upon the school board to come forward with some kind of contrary evidence, and they didn't do that. There was no true evidence that refuted the value of the property. It was simply, again, the same argument that we hear today, which is that somehow a foreclosure auction should, in and of itself, invalidate the value determined at each level so far. So it's difficult to determine whether they're making a purely legal argument at this stage or whether they're still making somewhat of a factual argument that goes to the heart of the value of the property. As I understand it, they're really making a purely legal argument and resting on the proposition that a foreclosure auction is not an arm's length transaction, that somehow by its very nature it is a forced sale. And again, the evidence does not support that. I believe the case law doesn't support that either. Unless there are any further questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. DiMuzio, you've reserved 1 minute and 10 seconds for rebuttal.
There is no per se rule that we're trying to advocate. If you look at our notice of appeal, you won't see the word auction. It appears anywhere in it. If you look at the errors complained of, you won't see the word auction used. They want us to argue about that because they think they can win that argument. That's not ours. It was simply involuntary, and it was for, and that's it. Whether it was an auction, whether someone gives someone 60 days and forces them to negotiate a price, it's involuntary. That's the key thing. On the jurisdictional issue, It can be raised at any time, of course. That's a longstanding rule. The Supreme Court controls and regulates the practice of law, not Dave DiMuzio. I suppose I could have objected. It really didn't have any import. The court's allowed to come back on its own motion, or we can certainly point out wherever we feel there's been improper. Mr. Fennell did argue about Exhibit 2. I mentioned that. If you want to go and check the record, you'll see that. He also tried to submit Exhibits 2 and 3 in evidence. These are the sorts of things that attorneys do. These were not his own personal items from his own personal file. They were third-party documents. And therefore, he was doing something that only an attorney should do. They do not meet the exceptions of Dayton Supply.
Thank you, Mr. DiMuzio. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.
Thank you.
Its decision.
Thank you.
Its decision.
Thank you.